Accession number 27244, Mr. John Lincoln, Reel 8. Now, we're talking about the Malayan servants. You're just running through the various different roles they perform for you. What else? You coffee making?
Yeah, you always had this guy. He was a sort of a coffee urn. And, urn of hot water, and he'd make you coffee or tea. And he'd also sell you rolls known as banjos. And you had a variety of these. The most famous one, of course, is the egg banjo. You know why it's called a banjo? Because they put the egg in it, and they wouldn't cook the yolk. So you bite into it, and you've got down the front of your uniform. Egg banjo. I suppose that's only a story. But it's he was the guy. And, of course, you could get tick from this guy. You could put it on the slate. And it was a feature, especially at Neesoon Garrison, where everybody in the garrison was a transit garrison, and everybody transits through there. And, of course, the banjo boys had a little book in which they'd enter up who they'd sold stuff to. And, of course, you'd get Roy Rogers and the Cisco Kid and all sorts of strange people that buy banjos off the banjo boy. And, of course, the regimental sergeant major would get everybody out on the square. And the banjo boy paraded with his book. And you got a real wigging from the regimental sergeant major. And he went around, "Would Roy Rogers step forward? You owe $1.25 to the banjo boy." And it was just a way of life, And that was a regular occurrence. That was him collecting his debts before people got posted up country and legged it without paying their money, But they were these things. Of course, the cleaners were all local natives, and they kept the barracks extremely immaculate. So you got your laundry done, you got your so-so done, you had a guy made your bed. He used to work through the barracks, and everyone paid him a few cents. The service wasn't free. I mean, you actually paid for this.
And how did you get on with them, generally?
They were wonderful people.
There was a good relationship with them.
Oh, yeah, very good. And quite a lot of them were ex-servicemen from the Indian Army. Quite a lot of them had come to the garrison, to Singapore and that, when the Indian Army disbanded, when it got its independence in the 40s. And their whole families moved to Malaya and lived with the British Army. And they were all employed by the British Army. I mean, you had a laundry system, second to none. You had all these servants and all the guys, the general factotums around the place, all employed in all the camps. Because, I mean, Singapore Garrison was a big place. There was an awful lot of troops in Singapore in those days.
Now, so you're working in the stores and going on these jaunts, that's the wrong word, but going into up into Malaya.
Up into Malaya, yeah.
Any other duties?
Well, you had your duties in the garrison because you had, being the garrison staff, people moved in and out of Singapore all the time. I mean, there was a large naval base, for instance, which catered for the Far East fleets of New Zealand, Australia, the Americans, and they came in and out. So we had garrison duties as well. You had a police type system where you went and you did police duties down in the town.
What was that like? So patrols, basically.
Well, yeah. Well, for instance, there was a large naffy club called Britannia Club, and there was the China Fleet Club, which these were establishments which catered for service people moving in and out when they were on leave. And these all had to have a standing staff to keep the peace, so the soldiers didn't get into trouble with the local authorities. The Chinese, I believe, Malayan police of the island. See, at that time, Lee Kuan Yew had just taken over. And again, Singapore was hoping for independence. Lee Kuan Yew took over and he was a very, very strong Chinese politician, and he cleaned up Singapore's act, if you like, because it was a den of iniquity. If I can explain to you, when you got off the aeroplane, you reported in and you were signed in to the garrison through a transport reception. One of the first things they gave you was the out-of-bounds card. This was a card with a map of Singapore, and all the black bits you were not allowed to go to as a serviceman. And there was more black bits than non-black bits, if you see what I mean. Because it was really a melting pot of Singapore, and you had everything that was nasty going on, which was illicit as far as the soldiers were concerned. And this is the first thing you got, your out-of-bounds card. You got that with your duty-free ration card, because everything was rationed, beer was rationed and so on, and you only got a certain amount of duty-free stuff, which was your entitlement, cigarettes, beer and so on. But these two cards were given to you on your first arrival, and they were your constant companions all the time you were there. And if you were caught out of bounds, you got severely reprimanded. I mean, they really meant it, you know. But there was a system on the island where all the interesting places were out of bounds, if you see what I mean. Everything that was sort of interesting and good was out of bounds, and the only way to get there was in a pirate taxi. There was the standard taxi companies, but then there was these, what they called pirate taxis. You know, the normal taxi cab, you can take three passengers in the back. Well, the pirate taxi could cram 8-9 people in, no problem. And you'd pay them a dollar a time, and away you'd go into the out of bounds areas to all the nightclubs and so on and so forth, and all the places where you weren't supposed to go. So there was a roaring trade in that.
And what were they like, the out of bounds areas? I mean,
well, they were interesting because this was, if you can imagine Singapore, I'm told, I've not been there for God, 40 years, but nowadays it's a huge modern city. Well, in those days it wasn't. It was the city as it had been from colonial times, and then interspaced between it was kampongs, or native villages, which were quite bizarre places where the houses were made of all sorts of things. And all sorts of illicit trades went on through there. I mean, drug smuggling is not a new thing for Singapore. I mean, it was rife in those days. I mean, let's face it, the opium trade was quite extensive. It's all happened. We talk about it today, opium. You think, oh, that's quite quaint. Considering all the nasty things they've got now in the drug world. But all that went on, you see, and that's why, as a serviceman, you weren't allowed to go in these places.
But you did.
Of course you did. I mean, we were young, we were interested, and it was fascinating to go and see everything. I mean, I had friends in the Singapore Guard Regiment, which was a Malaya locally enlisted regiment. And I met them through my duties with the medical service. And they used to take us to all sorts of temple festivals and so forth, which were very, very interesting. And I had a wee camera and I got loads of photographs of the Thai Pusan festival, for instance. That's the festival where the Hindus flagellate themselves and they stick skewers through their tongues and all sorts of things. And this is the pain takes away the sin, is the idea. And they do fire walking, you know, beds of red hot coals in their bare feet. It's fascinating to go and see all this, you know. And these boys used to take us, and we'd go into the out of bounds areas and see all this. Me and my two buddies from the Peco, we lived in a room. The three of us lived in a room together, and we had Akid and Imam. Akid and Imam, I think they called them. These two corporals from the Singapore Guard Regiment, and they take us to all these places. Oh, there's such and such happens, and off we'd go in a pirate taxi in the out of bounds areas and take photographs and have a native meal and so forth. It was a real, real good relationship.
Now, so anything happened while you were out there? I mean, anything you particularly remember, or funny stories, just things that happened?
Not really. It was pretty routine. It was just a nice place to be stationed. And I was quite sad to leave it, because...
How long were you out there? You were there, what, July 61-ish?
July 61 to March 62.
Sorry.
About 9 months. See, postings in those days were funny things, because you had national servicemen, and they used to move them around like counters on a board, you know. And we regulars were just in the general melee. If you were lucky, you got 3 years in some place. But a lot of the time, you got anything up to a year, and then you were moved on to something else. And as I say, at the time, I'd been agitating. I wanted to change trades and become hospital administration.
Now, I sort of glossed past that, but now, why did you want to become hospital administration? Because that would mean you're even more stuck in hospital, wouldn't it?
Well, yes and no, but it's general duties. Well, promotion was better. You see, when you're doing surgical and that, the promotion was quite slow. You get to corporal, which I was, and then you got stuck. But if you do general duties, there was many, many more acting promotions, and of course your substantive promotion would come after you had been acting. So most of us tried, if possible, to get on general duties, which could be employed anywhere. I mean, my first job when I came back to United Kingdom, okay, was sent back to the depot again.
Hang on, so is there anything else about Singapore? Is that pretty well finished, that, I think?
That's pretty well finished, yes. Right.
So you left in...
It was a nice holiday.
So you left in March 62.
Yes.
And came back to... Anything about the journey back?
No, it was the usual, as I say, the air trooping, and it was absolutely appalling. You know, because... It was such a long journey in those days. As I say, 24 hours you were moving. And talk about jet lag, because before the days of jets, you know, these were, I'm trying to think, there were propeller aircraft, Britannia Airways, and it was just an awful long journey. We came into Stansted, which was the... entry port in those days for military aircraft, for air trooping. And then...
Now, what was you? What, you rode back to Aldershot, or what happened?
Yes, I was on my way back to Aldershot, to the depot, as I say, to start on my new career as general duties.
You'd been accepted for that?
I was accepted for that, yes. I said, fine, you know. And
now, is this general duties within the dental corps? Or yes. Yes, not general duties within the RAMC.
It's, well, it is in the RAMC, yes. I mean,
I know it's part of it, but...
Yeah, you could be, it depended on which unit you were with. I mean, as it happened, I went back to the training depot of the Royal Army Dental Corps. And my first duty, I was trained in ration storming.
So that's the training depots at Aldershot.
Yes, it was the induction depot for the corps. All your recruits came through there. And I my first job in my new role was I was trained to do ration stores, which was a completely separate job in those days.
Now, what training do you need as ration storeman? I mean,
well, you went to Clayton Barracks, which was the home of the Royal Army Service Corps Supply, and you took a course on how to deal with the rations for the... Because the ration system in the Army was run by the Royal Army Service Corps and the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. And all your odd bods, all your corps, all your units... had a designated team of people who dealt with this particular aspect of stores.
Now, what was there to learn? Was there much to learn?
Yes, so you did a week's course at the Army Capering Corps headquarters, where you generally knew how to run the Russian scales, because if you can imagine, the army had a system whereby each man had his allocated ration. Now, this was known as home ration scale number 3. And they worked out what it took to sustain a soldier per day. And you had to know all about that so you could put your indents in and get the food and so forth to give to the catering service. Because the catering service were cooks, were issued to a unit, if you like, and they ran the kitchen, supported by the ration supply, i.e. the Russian stores and the storeman that ran it. And you worked on a sort of a 4-day system whereby you got the figures in from the administration office of how many people you were going to be catering for, you were going to feed, your feeding strength, if you like, over the next 4 days. And you had to work out how many pounds of this and pounds of that you would require. And you placed the indents with the service corps and the ordnance corps and the NAFI. And you then supplied the food to feed the garrison in your unit.
And so you went on courses to the Royal Army Service Corps and Army Catering Corps to learn how to do this.
That's right. That's right.
And then your first posting was as ration storeman to the training depot?
To the training depot.
At Aldershot.
Yes.
Right. Now, what were your duties like there? Tell us a bit about the duties. I mean, you've sketched in the system, but what did it mean in practice?
Well, you had to collect the stores from the different stores depots and then distribute within the unit once you had got them. Now, you had a 4-day system of supply for meats, for instance, which you collected from the abattoir. You put your indents in at the beginning of the week for the whole week, and then at 3-day intervals, you went with a truck to the abattoir and collected how much ration of meat you had, and you brought that back to the ration stores and distributed it to the butcher shops, the butchery department within the catering service within your barracks, the officers' mess, the sergeant's mess, and the men's mess. They got their division of how many people who were feeding, and you had to divvy it all up, weigh it off, take it in, and then the cooks would look after it and sort it. You'd get your dry rations once a month. That's the tin stuff, things like bully beef and dehydrated potato and peas. And now you got the figures in from the central administration of who you had to feed. Now they would quote you a week in advance what the messing strength was going to be. What you had to do in those days, the messing system allowed for, well, for instance, home ration scale number 3 to quart used to be, for instance, 1 egg per man per day. So if you had 600 men, that was 600 eggs you wanted. It was 2 ounces of butter per day, 4 ounces of lard, 4 ounces, half a pound of flour, so many ounces of sugar. So what you had to do is you had to work out how many men you had, work out how much provision you would need, and order it accordingly, and put in your orders to the different supply depots around the garrison. Then on the allocated day, go and collect it, and then issue it to the different areas inside the camp, i.e. the officers' mess, the sergeant's mess, and the main kitchens. So that's what your duties were as a ration storeman. It was quite an exacting job, because you did it all by hand. You didn't have vehicles and that sort of thing. For instance, we used to have what they called hand carts, and this hand cart was pushable by one man or two men, and you used to go down to the different storehouses with your hand cart, collect your rations and bring them back to the unit and put them in the unit. You got lorries occasionally, but not that often, so everything was done by hand. It sounds, in this day and age, it sounds quite primitive. It was, if you look at it that way. Now, also, as the Russian storeman, you were also responsible for things like the swill from the kitchens, because that meant money, and you sold that swill to a swill man, you know, a pig man, if you like. He came round, and you were paid for that. And that money went into the rationing account to buy the best things in life, because there wasn't anything, there was no fancies. You had a basic ration, which didn't cater for things. I mean, you didn't get any fancy things like cakes or anything like that. Those had to be produced from what you had and your main rations. So with the Nafi, you had what they call a ration cash account, which you could go down and buy nice things to just to supplement to the diet and make things a bit attractive. So when you got your figures in at the beginning of the week, you were allowed to convert to cash so many rations, a certain percentage of the rations. So remember, it was about 15% of the rations you were allowed to convert to cash, which went into the cash account for the ration stores, and that account you used to go to the Nafi and buy specialised things. Things like, for instance, cake making materials. You didn't get them issued, you had to buy them. Things like jellies. You didn't get that issued, you had to buy it. So you had to balance this against the issue, so you got an overall all-round diet. I mean, you were helped by the chef. I mean, the cook sergeant, he'd tell you what he would want, and you worked it out between you.
And so you were on this, what, from April 62?
April 62 until September-ish, 63. I had just over a year doing ration stores, and I moved from ration stores onto clothing stores.
Now, is that at the same place?
Oh yes, it's all within the quartermaster department of the training centre.
Now, what difference did that make?
Well, I had to take another.
What the system was? I mean,
I had to take yet another course and learn how to deal with generalised items, because working in the general store, we had clothing. We had the furniture and fittings of the unit, known as accommodation stores in the army. So you took a course on how to handle accommodation stores and clothing. And you went to the ordnance.
How do you handle them?
Well, every man has an entitlement, and you have to know what the entitlements are. You have to know where to indent for them through the ordnance service. Get the clothes in. I mean, you get an issue of clothing, for instance, once a fortnight to cater for the guys that were coming in, and also to cater for those who were already there, because they have a certain replacement type system whereby you got things like socks and shirts and so forth replaced. But you had to get the stocks in of these, and you had to know where to go for them and how to indent for them. Same with accommodation stores. I mean, inside a big unit like that, you always had a replacement breakage system whereby you did once a month a complete survey of the unit to get replacements which had been broken, stolen or strayed, and replace them to keep the place at a reasonable standard. You're like the steward of a big house, if you like.
Now, one thing we've got to ask, and I'm not suggesting anything at all, but that, you know, the old army thing that the stores, there's always the odd fiddle going on. I don't think there always is, but
there is.
Well, I don't know whether you're involved or how you want to tackle this, but I mean, we'd like to know at what level the fiddling was going on and whether you were part of it, I suppose.
Well, you made things. For instance, the laundry. You sent things to the laundry. Torn sheets, that sort of thing. When the torn sheet come back, you'd carefully divide it into two, fold it, and when you sent in for your replacements for the sheets, you'd get two sheets for one, if you see what I mean. These were legitimate fiddles. And you take these down to the central storehouses, and you'd put your dead stuff in and get new stuff out. I mean, cups, for instance, if you could keep the handles of the cups, you had more handles than you had cups, if you see what I mean. And so you'd get a few extra. This was all legitimate. I mean, you couldn't really say it was a fiddle. You were just legitimately keeping your stock up to replace.
So this is fiddles within the army system.
Yes.
Not for personal profit. Now, was the personal profit stuff going on as well?
No, that's a fallacy.
So the fiddles are army fiddles, not stealing.
Not personal fiddles, no.
It's basically for the advantage of your unit and...
yeah, exactly.
To manipulate it.
You manipulate the system, yes. Yes. I mean, dustbins, for instance, was a fair... We had a storeman, because the storemen were very crafty guys as well, you know, that ran the central stores. I mean, the dustbins wear out. And this guy in the stores where I used to go to get my dustbins replaced, he had plaster casts of the damage you could do to a dustbin. For instance, there was one where you put your foot through the bottom. There was a plaster cast at that. There was one where someone used a pickaxe to damage this bin to get a replacement because it was a bit iffy and you needed a new one. So what you would do, you'd damage it and take the one and say, oh, look, this one's worn out. And he'd say, oh, no, it's not. You damaged that. And he'd charge you for it. He'd charge your unit for a new bin. So for free replacements, you had to be really crafty to make sure that they were of such a state that you could go and do that. I mean, for instance, toilet paper, lavatory paper. You've got to believe it. In the book, it says each man is entitled to 4 sheets per man per day. You know, one down, one across, and one to polish. So you worked out your indent for toilet paper on how many men you had at 4 sheets per man per day. Light bulbs. You had to take the brass end of a light bulb in to get a replacement for it. And if you didn't produce the brass end, you didn't get a replacement. So it was this system's going on all the time, you see.
So it's a bit of a game play between you and the central stores.
That's right.
With both sides having a bit of a go.
Oh, yes, I was all good-humoured.
Did you like this work?
Yes, I
still
did.
Still a corporal or any promotion?
No, I was still a corporal.
And anything else about that? Or...
No, that's about it. Because I then moved from there, from general stores.
Now, when did you move? You were there from September 63 to...
September 62? Yeah, okay. I did I did the ration stores, then I did general stores, and then I moved on to medical stores.
Still at the same place?
Still at the same place. And then I got acting sergeant in the medical stores.
That was a good step forward.
Oh, yeah.
Now, but first let's have a look at what your duties were in the medical stores.
Accounting for stores. The whole thing was geared to that. Again, you work to a central store system, you put in your indents, and that's the full range of instruments, drugs and so forth, and just general medical stores.
And what difference did it make being an acting sergeant? I mean, you know...
Well, you got more pay. You got better accommodation because you moved into the sergeant's mess.
What was the sergeant's mess like?
Well, it was a club. A very specialised club, the sergeant's mess.
Describe it a bit for us.
Well, you had... for the first time, you got your own room, for instance. You had each sergeant has his own room, which as a corporal and below you don't. You slept in the barracks.
And what was the room like?
Well, quite austere really. You had a locker and a bed, and a wee shelf for your books. But you had a door you could shut, and you got privacy, which is what you didn't get as a corporal and below in the general barracks. You also had a better standard of entertainment, if you like, because it's, as I say, it's like a club. You have the
What's
main.
What's it like in the mess?
What's that describe? If you can imagine, it's like belonging to a private club. You had a snooker room, and you had a television room, but it's all tastefully furnished, and you've got privacy.
Was it a hard drinking mess?
Not really, no. That's a fallacy. People talk about the boozing and all that. It wasn't like that at all. I mean, don't forget, in those days, in fact, even now, to have a beer is a way of life in the mess, because that's the way you socialise. So therefore, the mess has a bar, you use the bar. It's expected of you. Because that's giving money to the mess to run with. They don't make any profit if they don't sell any beer, if you see what I mean. But it isn't, it's not boozing 24 hours a day. No, that's a fallacy.